The book of Habakkuk. We've been doing this summer, and this book is a dialogue between God and one of his people. It's a really informative book for us. Sometimes you may wonder, why are these books in the Bible? I think there's some real clear reasons. This tells us what it is like to have a conversation with God as our Father. It begins with Habakkuk's, not just prayer, but complaint, which is interesting. Thank you. I appreciate that. Don't we have great kids? We do have great kids. Kids, you've got your notes there, so follow along and fill those things out and color to your heart's content, and then I'll ask you some questions at the end. This book begins with a complaint from a man to God. It's about the evil and violence that he sees all around him that are plaguing his nation, that are plaguing his people. And he also looks and he sees the leaders of his nation and their rejection of the Lord and his word. And as he looks nearby, he sees the rising threat of terror and possible destruction at the hands of this terroristic group. They call themselves the Babylonians or Chaldeans, as it's named in here. And so as he looks around at all that and he's considering God and where he is, he has a challenge to God. And so he lists his complaint. He basically says to God, which some of these things you may have said, you may have heard, God, why do you allow evil to prosper? And if you're God and if you are good, then why are good things happening and bad things happening to good people? And why aren't you doing something about it? Now, that's pretty cheeky, isn't it? It's good to know that's in the Bible, because I think some of us have probably done that ourselves, right? And God answers him, and he says to him, Habakkuk, look, I want you to see what I'm doing in the world. You'll be amazed, because there's much more going on than you can imagine. Last week we read, as God went on to tell Habakkuk, that it was God that had raised up the Babylonians, and he had done it for a reason, for judgment, for the wicked, and as a reproof. And a reproof is a word we don't use anymore, but it means a reprimand or a rebuke or a warning. God had done that not just for the world, but for his own people, to turn them away from sin and rebellion and to turn them back toward their Creator. Habakkuk understood that, and in verse 12, when God finishes telling him that, his initial response is a good one. He says, are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, and my Holy One? We shall not die. In other words, the nation will not be destroyed. We shall not all die. I love that. So he responds with faith initially, and I love that he says, my God, my Holy One. You see, that's personal to him, because the Lord is his God. And in this, Habakkuk recognizes, too, that other people have other gods. This is my Lord. This is my God. Other people have other gods. I was struggling a little bit with how to relate to Muslims and how to relate to the idea of Muhammad as a prophet and Allah as God. And a gentleman that I heard talking one time kind of helped me sum this up. And so now when someone talks to me, when I talk to a Muslim and they talk about the prophet Muhammad, I can very clearly say to them, he may be your prophet, but he's not my prophet. And Allah may be your God, but he's not my God. They're different gods. And that begs the question for all of us, who is your God? My God is the God of the Bible. And it's fair to ask other people the question, get them to consider, who is your God? And I'm not just talking about Jesus or Allah or Buddha. Those are the things we generally think about, but that's not all a God is or can be. A God is some sort of supreme or ultimate reality where your beliefs really lie. That's what your God is. It's your reality, your beliefs, where your thoughts really lie. To whom or to what do you assign your loyalty? What principles that accompany your beliefs? What are they that guide and inform the way you live your life? Because everybody will have those. Everybody will have a set of beliefs. Everybody will have some sort of guideline by which they rule their lives and live. A God may be a disembodied spirit. A God may be an idea. A God may be a principle. A God may be a person. A God may be some group or an object or a philosophy or even someone's consciousness and ability to reason can be their God. God comes in many forms. But there's a truth that we need to understand, and it's this, that every God comes with its own demands. Every God. Whatever we serve will have its own demands. And eventually, every man, every woman, every boy and girl are going to have to decide for themselves who or what they will serve in this life. In Habakkuk's day, he knew that the Babylonians had a God. And he knew that his God, their God was very different than his God. Today, we know that ISIS has a God, and that their God is very different than our God. The Lord said this of the Babylonians, and I think it could equally be applied to ISIS these days. In Habakkuk 1:7, their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. They're their own rule. They are their own law. In verse 9, God says, they all come for violence. That was what the Babylonians were all about. And today that's what ISIS is all about. People go and they join up from all around the world. They go up and they join up with ISIS. Why are they there? For violence. In Habakkuk 1:11, God describes the Babylonians, and I think this also could be his description of ISIS, as guilty men whose own might is their God. The Babylonians may have said that Marduk was their God. ISIS may say that Allah is their God. The fact is, if you look at their actions, their own might is their God. So, it begs the question of Habakkuk and of us, who or what is my God? Habakkuk knew his answer immediately in spite of his complaining. Habakkuk knew who he was praying to, and he knew where his trust lay. In Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 12, he responds to what God has told him. He says, are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. He knows his God. He knows he's the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He knows he is the God of the Holy Scriptures. He knows he is the God who gave him life. He knows who his God is. Then he signals his understanding of God's answer and of God's plan for his people and his nation. He goes on and he says, O Lord, I get it. You have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O Rock, have established them for reproof. I get it. Case closed. God spoke to me, right? End of the book. That's the end of Habakkuk, right? I got it. God spoke. That's it. It's done. Is that the end of the book? No. We'll see today that Habakkuk was, he got it right then, but he was immediately concerned again with doubt and fear and misunderstanding and worry. Oh, poor old Habakkuk. God spoke to him. He went to God, asked his questions. God speaks to him directly, and he just falls on his face and turns immediately back to fear and to concern. Let me ask you, have you ever had God answer your prayers and you thought, you know what? I will never doubt him again. Anybody ever said that? Anybody ever thought that? God comes through in a big way and you go, what? I will never doubt God again. Only to turn around and doubt him again. If you've done that, let me just tell you, you're in good company. It's right here in the Bible, okay? This is one of the reasons that God has this book, this story of the conversation between God and one of his people in the Bible. It's for us. It's for our benefit. It's so that we know that when we have doubts, whenever we have doubts, we can go to God with him because God will not abandon his children. He's not going to reject you if you go to him with your complaint or your doubt. Maybe like us, Habakkuk sometime needed more reassurance that God is in charge, that everything would be okay. You know, we probably all had at one point in our lives some glimpse into the reason why bad things are happening to us, where God showed up and you went, oh, I'm starting to get this. I understand. And even when that's happening and you think, I'm now connected with God, everything's going to be all right. That's not usually the end of the story, because we also want to know not just that he's going to fix it, we want to know when he's going to fix it, right? When will it finally be okay? God, when can I expect some relief? Like Habakkuk, God, you know, we've read God's promises in the Bible. You know, Habakkuk had read God's promises to Joshua. He had that book. And in Joshua 1:7, God speaks to Joshua and he says, no man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. Habakkuk knows this. He knows this is God's heart, not just toward Joshua, but really toward all of his people. So he's got that in the somewhat distant past. He's also just following the prophet Jeremiah as the prophet to Judah. Jeremiah was the prophet in Judah during the reign of a good king, a guy named Josiah. And Habakkuk now lives just a little after that, and he has seen Israel turn back once again. Even after this big revival and return to God, he's seen them turn back again and turn away from God. But he may have even known Jeremiah, but he certainly has read his writings. And he knows that God told his people in Jeremiah 29:11 this, for I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and a hope. He knows that's what God said to this nation that he's so concerned about, because the Babylonians are coming against them and because their own rulers are so wicked. He knows that. He knows God. He trusts God. He loves God. He fears God. And so his initial response is one of faith. He prays, God answers. And you know what? It's an amazing thing when God answers you and you know that God is personally invested in your life. He's listening to your prayers, your concerns, and he shows up and he answers you in a very personal way. That's awesome when God does that. But then in the next moment, when everything is not suddenly resolved, what happens? You once again doubt God's intentions, or you worry about his timing. God, do you not know? Time's running out. You worry about his ability. Can you not do anything about this? You worry about his goodness. You worry about his justice, his fairness, his love. We all have. And we're not alone. In 1 Kings 18, there's the story of this prophet named Elijah. You've probably heard of him, and the prophets of Baal. It's one of the coolest stories for me in the Bible. And if you haven't read it, I just want to encourage you to do so, because it will encourage you. It's a contest that's been arranged between God and this god Baal to see who really has power. And so 450 prophets, there's Elijah, and there's 450 prophets of Baal that come out. And they're going to have this showdown between God and Baal. And so they set up altars with wood on them. And they put a sacrifice on there. And then Jeremiah, being the gentleman, says, that's okay, you guys go first. Right? And so they do. And they do whatever they do to worship Baal and to talk to him. I don't know what they did. But they did it for a really long time. They started early in the morning. They went all the way up into the midday sun. And they finally just totally wore themselves out trying to get Baal to drop fire on this thing and accept their sacrifice. And you know what happened? Nothing. When they had finally run out of gas, Elijah goes, okay, you guys through? All right, give me some water. They started bringing out barrels of water. They poured it over the fire. Over his wood several times, till it says there was water just running off of it in the trenches around it. And everybody saw this, and he said, okay, well, y'all ready? Let me pray. He prays a very simple prayer. Fire drops from heaven, consumes everything. Right? And the people are upset, and so the prophets of Baal are killed. And now, come on. If that was you, and you said one prayer, these other people have been through all this stuff, you said one prayer, fire drops from heaven when you ask God to do it, consumes everything like that, would you be on a little bit of a spiritual high? Yeah, just a wee, okay? Would you think in that moment, I will never doubt God again? Would you think that? You know, that's not what happened. In 1 Kings chapter 19, here's what happens the next minute. Ahab, who was the king at the time, told Jezebel, his wife, who, by the way, happened to worship Baal, all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword, and she was mad. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." What's she saying? I'm going to kill you. Or I'm going to have you killed, whatever it is. Then he was afraid. And he arose and ran for his life. And he came to Beersheba, which belonged to Judah, and he left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, and he came and he sat down under a broom tree all by his lonesome. You know, this is the thing. You see God's prophets doing this more than once in the Bible. This didn't work out the way I wanted it to. I'm going to go sulk in the desert somewhere. Right? And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life. I am no better than my fathers. I just want to die. Could you just kill me, God?" Now, that's a prayer that God did not answer. Well, he answered. He just said, "No, I'm not going to do that." You've probably read the rest of the story. Did God reject Elijah that day for his doubt, for his depression? Did he reject him? No? Is he going to reject you for your doubt, your depression? No? See, God picked Elijah up. He encourages him. He sends him back to be the prophet to his people. And the Lord used him to perform many more miracles to display God's glory and power. And the coolest part of this story to me is that not only did God not reject him, do you know that Elijah didn't die? He didn't die. God sent a whirlwind with a chariot and horses made of fire to pick this guy up and take him off into heaven. And then he appears again in the New Testament with Moses, sent by God the Father to have a conversation with Jesus while he's here on earth, and is prophesied that he will return again before Jesus returns. Pretty cool thing. See, God does not reject us for our fears. He doesn't reject us when we doubt. He doesn't reject us when we make complaints to him. He just loves us. And he stands with us in those times. But here's the point. He will not leave you there. He will take you out of that dark place. So if you're in one of those places this morning, I just want to encourage you. God is not rejecting you, and he's not going to leave you there. He will come for you. Now back to Habakkuk. God has spoken to Habakkuk in answer to his prayer and complaint. He's answered his question about why he's doing this. And then in the very next moment, we see that Habakkuk's heart wavers, and he's overwhelmed by fear and doubt. And so, once again, he pours out yet another complaint to God, and I want us to read this, starting in verse 13. He just said, "Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die." Then in verse 13, he goes, "Okay, God, you who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong, why do you idly look at traitors?" He's talking about the leaders of his own people. "Why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he?" Now, he says something here that I think was prophetic, and I don't think he knew what he was saying. He says, "You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings all of them up with a hook. He drags them out of his net. He gathers them in his dragnet, so he rejoices and is glad." That's prophetic. Do you know how the Babylonians took the Hebrews, the Jews, into captivity? They would come get them with big nets, literally. And then when they captured them, they would put big hooks in their lips with chains on them, and they took them back to Babylon that way. "Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet." That is more about the Babylonians and that they worship their own violence, their own power. "For by them he lives in luxury and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever?" See, this is a real threat. When I read this and I read about the nets and the fish and all that kind of stuff, I can't help but I have those images from last year of those Egyptian Coptic Christians and the Ethiopian Christians in those separate incidents on the beach in North Africa being led out by ISIS to their death. I can't help but make that same connection. Having read this and understanding that God commanded Habakkuk to write this down so that you and I can read it today, perhaps you might begin to forgive yourself if you've ever had God answer your prayers and then you've immediately doubted his goodness again. This is what we all struggle with as humans. This is what we all struggle with as Christians. Being a Christian is not about having everything sorted out and having all the answers. We have to wrestle with God as well. See, faith, and if you don't hear anything else I say today, faith is not the absence of doubt. I want you to understand that. Faith is not the absence of doubt. Hebrews 11:1 tells us what it is. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Some of the newer translations say that faith is the reality of things hoped for. That's faith, and that's the reality. And that reality is available only to us as disciples of Jesus Christ, as citizens of God's kingdom here on earth. That's how we have faith. Because we've been born again. Not as children of the flesh this time, but as children of God. And this reality undergirds the faith that gives us confidence in uncertain times. Because our faith is not in faith, and our faith is not in something. Our faith is in God. It's in nothing else. Our faith is in the Creator, the ruler of the universe, and we know that His dominion extends over all things, both now and forever. And nothing escapes His notice, and nothing is outside of His control. In Romans 8:37-39, it says this, "In all these things, we are more than conquerors through Him who loved us. For I am sure that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor rulers, nor things present, nor things to come, nor powers, nor height, nor depth, nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus our Lord." That's our reality. That's what our God is like. But you know, you can know all that, and when you're facing true evil, when you are facing present danger, when you are looking at the imminent threat of losing everything that you know and love, including maybe even your own life, where do you stand before the Lord? How do you stand there, even knowing that He is God, with faith in your heart? How do you endure? How do those people on that beach in North Africa stand there with the faith to continue to worship God and even sing His praise, knowing that they were going to their certain death? Well, this book is also instructive in how to do that. Listen to what Habakkuk says after this complaint. Verse 1. I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower and look out to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. He makes this complaint, and then he doesn't go hide in a cave somewhere. He goes out to his post. He goes out to his watchtower. What's he doing when he's out there? Or what is he doing? He's watching, and he's waiting. Well, what's he waiting for? The Babylonians to come over the hill? What is he waiting for? God has already answered him and told him why and how he's using the Babylonians to call people to repentance. Habakkuk knows that the nation, that the people of God are not going to die. He's already stated that. They're not going to end, they're not going to be gone forever. They will survive. What else does he want from God? What's he doing? He's watching. What's he watching for? He's not watching for the what. He's already got that part figured out. What's he watching for? He's looking for the when. The when. When's God going to do this? It's one thing to have a firm understanding that God will make all things right one day, that justice will triumph, that violence and wars will cease, that good will overcome evil eventually, that Jesus will come as king and reign forever and ever. It's one thing to know all that, and that the bad things that I'm dealing with now will be resolved one day, and that God's favor will yet be experienced in my life, in my family, in my city, in my nation. But when? Isn't that what you want to know? Because right now, God, things look pretty bleak. How can we live out our faith in uncertain times when it looks like evil is spreading all around us? Well, we have the example of Habakkuk. Again, this is why it's in here. It wasn't that Habakkuk didn't have doubts. He did. Wasn't that he didn't complain. He did. It wasn't that he wasn't concerned. It wasn't that he saw the end that God had in mind. God didn't show him specifically what was going to happen. He hadn't seen the end yet, but we'll get to that in a couple of weeks. So what did he do in light of his faith in God and his belief in God's goodness? He did what he knew to do, and that was he prayed. He let his complaints be made known to God, and then he waited faithfully to see the outcome, to see the when. And isn't that where we live now? We're waiting to see the outcome, the return of Christ, the when. But see, here's the thing. He didn't wait in a passive way. He didn't just roll over and let evil go unchecked. He didn't go hide somewhere. He took up God's call in his life. And he said this in essence: in this generation, I will stand my watch. Jeremiah and others that have gone before me have had their turn to be faithful to God and his word. And you know what? Now it's my turn. My turn to be faithful. My turn to stand. I will stand guard. I will wait to see the Lord's deliverance in my generation. I will know the Lord. I will trust his word. That's the decision he made. I will be ready to respond when God speaks. I will be ready to move when God moves. I will be ready to obey his commands when he commands me. He waited with expectation, with faith, ready to do what God would command when the time was right. Now that's a message we can take home with us today. We may wonder sometimes how we would do in Habakkuk's situation. How we would do in that situation were we the ones on the beach in North Africa. Or if we were the Christians in Syria when ISIS came in and started killing everybody and destroying everything and taking all their homes. You ever wonder how you would do there? Well, the Bible has something to say about that too, and I'm going to close with this today. The book of Esther is a story of one young woman who lived as a child of God in very difficult times. Her Hebrew family had been forcibly deported to the city of Susa, which is in the border region of today between Iraq and Iran. So they'd been forcibly taken out of Israel over into the border region of Iraq and Iran. As fierce as they were when God was done with the Babylonians, then they would be replaced by the Persians. And that's the time she lives in, just after Habakkuk. God's people were already in exile, but they were now forced to live by Persian rules under their government as a despised minority. You know why they were a despised minority? Because they had this strange religion with only one God. And they were despised. The king's minister was already planning a genocide because he wanted to exterminate them from the face of the earth because he thought the world would be better off without those people. The book of Esther captures the spirit of this godless age. Matter of fact, the book of Esther doesn't even contain the name of God. That's how godless the age was and the culture that she lived in. What could one girl do against such an enormous evil? Her parents had died when she was a child. She'd been raised by her uncle, a man named Mordecai. So this young girl, by the order of the king, living with her uncle, she was taken from her home. She was put into the king's harem to serve at his pleasure. What could this one girl do against that kind of might and power? But because God had made her beautiful, she found favor with the king. And it is from this place of influence that her uncle Mordecai speaks to her these prophetic words in the hope that she will be used by God to save his people. Esther 4:14. This is what Mordecai says. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. God will do what he's going to do. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. That one young girl in the midst of this godless empire. Today, all over the world, I want to tell you that Christian girls and boys and young men and young women and old men and old women, they're facing this same challenge. And they, too, are standing firm in their faith, praying and giving voice to their complaint, yes, but then watching and waiting for the Lord's deliverance. And so I want to leave you with this challenge this morning. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? What if God has called you for this time? Have you ever considered, why am I alive right now? At this place, at this moment in history, does God have a plan for me in this world today? What if it's your turn to be used by God, to be his ambassador, to bring life and salvation to people? By simply doing what Kevin talked about, by proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ in the face of opposition. When you look at the world around you, when you look at your family, your city, your nation, when you look at the terror and injustice that exists today, do you dare to lift up your voice in complaint to God? Will you take your stand on Jesus and his word, and will you wait faithfully for as long as it takes to see the answer of God? Because this is what it means to have faith in uncertain times. And that's the message of God for you from the book of Habakkuk. Call upon him, God says. Lift up your complaint. Listen then for his response. Wait and see the deliverance of God as he executes justice and righteousness on your behalf. Remain faithful to the Lord, your God. Remain faithful to the Bible, which is your reality, your rule of life. We all have choices to make. I encourage you to make good choices. Don't settle for just trying to make it in the world today. I'm just going to get by, just going to get through. Don't settle for that. Trust in Jesus. Speak with him about your concerns. Wait on his answers. And when you do that, you will get to know God's presence and his power. You will see remarkable answers to your prayers. You will see God do miracles. And then you're not just going to be existing. You're going to be really living. And the joy of the Lord will be your strength. Wait for the Lord. Be strong. Let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. Amen.